How would you like to be in the room where it happens? I mean, the room where U.S. presidents make their most consequential decisions and manage crises that determine the fates of nations. Well, you probably don't have the security clearance for that, but luckily, George Stephanopoulos has gotten access, and he writes about it in the new book, The Situation Room, The Inside Story of Presidents in Crisis, co-authored with Lisa Dickey. George is the political advisor turned journalist who hosts ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos and co-anchors Good Morning America. In his book, he shares harrowing stories spanning from the John F. Kennedy assassination to the January 6th insurrection. Here he is to share five of his key insights.
Hi, everyone. George Stephanopoulos here from ABC News, where I have covered presidents in the White House for more than 25 years. Before that, I actually worked in the White House as a senior advisor to President Bill Clinton, and I've poured all that experience into my new book, The Situation Room, The Inside Story of Presidents in Crisis, which looks at the history of the White House Situation Room, that nerve center of the White House, windowless, in the White House basement. Here are five key insights from my book, The Situation Room. Insight number one, information is power. That was the insight that drove John F. Kennedy to create the Situation Room back in 1961. It was just a few months into his presidency. He was actually given a memo by his military aide, Godfrey McHugh, a French-speaking debonair diplomat who actually once dated Jackie Kennedy, but he did not act on it until after the disastrous Bay of Pigs invasion, where the president took full responsibility but was fuming over the lack of good planning from the CIA, the lack of good information from the Joint Chiefs of Staff and other generals. So he set up this nerve center in the White House right after the Bay of Pigs. It took just 2 weeks to set up. It would be an information clearinghouse where the president could get intelligence from all over the government, but look at it on his own with his small team of loyal aides and not be beholden to the generals or the CIA or the State Department. Ironically, it turned out that John F. Kennedy didn't end up using the room all that much once it was built. It wasn't much to look at the time. He actually called it a pig pen. He did rely on the information from the Situation Room, but he didn't go there all that much, even during the Cuban Missile Crisis, where he was getting dispatches from the Situation Room, but ended up working with his executive committee at the Cabinet Room and inside the Oval Office. But that was just the beginning for the Situation Room. It has evolved over the last several decades, and the next president, LBJ, would use it more than any other. Insight number two, information is not insight. President Lyndon Johnson was an information junkie, hyper-connected in the pre-internet age. He loved telephones, every room in the White House, including the bathroom, 72 telephones on his ranch in Texas. And LBJ used the sit room probably more than any other president. He used it so much that he even moved his favorite chair down there for endless meetings, mostly about Vietnam. That was his obsession. LBJ did not believe the war could be won, but he could not figure out how to get out of it either. And he was always desperate for information about Vietnam, calling the Situation Room officers at all hours of the night for information on possible casualties, body counts, how battle plans were going. He famously even moved a model of Khe Sanh down into the Situation Room and looked at possible bombing strikes and battle plans. The problem for LBJ is that Vietnam was not a war that could be won, and the information he was getting about Vietnam could not tell him how the war would be going. Body counts were not an accurate measure of how the battle was going. No matter how much information Lyndon Johnson got, he could not find that nugget that would unlock the trap he was in Vietnam. And that was the tragedy of his presidency, the tragedy of a president who had so many domestic accomplishments in his short one-term presidency. Henry Kissinger said that Lyndon Johnson succumbed to what he called the Situation Room syndrome, the idea that the world could be managed from that room in the basement of the White House. But of course, Vietnam could not be controlled from the Situation Room. Richard Nixon, his successor, would not use the Situation Room all that much, in part because of the insights of Henry Kissinger. Of course, he would have problems of his own. Insight number three, experience matters to a point. Brent Scowcroft proves this insight. Like the man he served as National Security Advisor, President George H.W. Bush, he trained as an Air Force fighter pilot, but then worked his way up through the military in a series of jobs, teaching at the Air Force Academy and West Point, serving on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He first served in the White House as a military aide in the Nixon White House, then went on to become National Security Advisor to Gerald Ford, where he built up a strong relationship as well with President Bush, George H.W. Bush, who had served as ambassador to China and also head of the CIA. All that experience was brought to bear when he became National Security Advisor to President Bush during a time of tremendous change. And they managed with amazing skill both the fall of the Berlin Wall and the orchestration of the first war against Iraq. In fact, John Bolton, who went on to serve as National Security Advisor to President Trump, said that they were performing at the level of the 1927 Yankees. He had put together a team built on trust, based on his experience, that functioned at the absolute highest level. As the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Mark Milley, told me, Brent Scowcroft was the gold standard. A generation of national security professionals also grew up learning from the experience of the Desert One debacle under President Carter, that failed rescue mission during the Iran hostage crisis, including Admiral William McRaven, who went on to lead the Navy SEAL raid that took down Osama bin Laden during President Obama's administration. He went to school on that failure, fixing intelligence failures, fixing communications failures, making sure they had all the equipment they needed and a full dress rehearsal several times before they took on that successful raid. One other individual who, though, proves the point that experience only matters to a point is Robert Gates. He also had extensive experience in several administrations, going back in the CIA to President Carter's day, where he first experienced the Desert One debacle, worked his way up, serving as defense secretary to both President Obama and President George W. Bush. But he wrote in his memoir that at the time of the Osama bin Laden raid, all of that experience may have colored him too much. He warned President Obama that it may have made him too cautious. He was the only national security principal who argued against the raid on the first go-round when President Obama polled his advisors for their opinions on what to do. President Obama said no. He appreciated the insights that he was getting from Robert Gates, but it proves that point. You have to learn from experience, but not be paralyzed by it. Insight number four, desperate times spawn desperate measures. Probably the strangest story in my book was sparked by a diary entry from Jimmy Carter on May 8, 1980. It said, it was simple, one line, we had a session in the Situation Room concerning a parapsychology project where people can envision what exists at a particular latitude and longitude, etc. That was it, but it did kind of pique my interest because it talked about parapsychology. This was a desperate time during the Carter presidency. He was locked in a battle against Ronald Reagan. Inflation was soaring. Gas lines were long. And it was just 2 weeks after a disaster in the desert, the failed rescue mission to get the hostages who had been trapped in Iran for more than 6 months. I was able to track down a man who worked on the NSC for Carter at that time, Jake Stewart, a Navy captain, and it turned out he gave the briefing that day about parapsychology. He was reluctant to talk about it at first, but when we finally got him on the Zoom and I asked the question about what happened that day, his eyes widened and he told me an amazing story. What he did was brief President Carter on something called Operation Grill Flame, which was actually an Army program which was using psychics to try to help with gathering intelligence. He briefed Carter on what he thought were the successes over the last several years. And at the end of the meeting, Carter didn't say a word. He simply wrote one word on a piece of White House stationery and slid it across the table to Jake Stewart. Hostages? Question mark. Can you help? He asked. Jake Stewart said, yes, I think I can. And he went to work on it. And they proceeded to have six different remote viewer psychics in the U.S. government at the time working on trying to locate where those hostages were. Eventually, they were credited with helping to find hostage Richard Queen, who was suffering from multiple sclerosis, and he was brought back home. But of course, the rest of the hostages were not released until after Ronald Reagan defeated Jimmy Carter And on Inauguration Day, they were released. The hostage situation had completely crippled the Carter presidency. He was doing anything he could to try to solve it, even going to the point of calling in government psychics. In that time, desperate times certainly did call for desperate measures. Insight number five. The deep state is packed with patriots. At any one time, the Situation Room is staffed by several dozen individuals from across the government and military. Army, Navy, Air Force, CIA, NSA, State Department, Defense, Homeland Security. For some people, it's a stepping stone to higher levels in the government. For others, it's a capstone to a successful career. Across the board, these people are rigidly apolitical, rigorously apolitical. They are determined to serve the presidency, not the president, and they are patriots. People like Gary Bresnahan. Gary Bresnahan served for seven presidents. Son of a truck driver, mother who was on welfare, he worked his way into the Army as a cryptologist and then became simultaneously the Zelig and MacGyver of the sit room. He was in the sit room for just about every important mission over the last several decades. He was in the Situation Room when Reagan was shot. He was in the Situation Room on 9/11. He set up the secret communications link for Bill Clinton's grand jury testimony, and he set up the communications link that allowed President Obama and his team to see the takedown of Osama bin Laden in real time. Through it all, he was humble and dedicated to serving his country. People like Sally Batzai. She was the first woman from the National Security Agency to work in the Situation Room. She started under President Nixon, was there during the darkest days of impeachment, his last day in office, served through President Ford, determined to carry on through tumultuous times. Individuals like Ed Podinsky, a naval officer, he rushed to the Situation Room from his child's kindergarten classroom on 9/11 so he could be there on watch when the White House was under attack. He and several of his colleagues refused to leave, even when they were told they had to evacuate because a plane or a missile could be coming straight for the White House. He served through those days, even though he lost several of his colleagues from the Pentagon, from the Naval Operations Office, who were actually attacked on 9/11. And he was on watch on the aircraft carrier when Osama bin Laden was given his final burial at sea. He said that gave a kind of closure to his experience, and he knew his colleagues from the Navy were there in spirit. Individuals like Mike Stiegler. For Mike Stiegler, working in the Situation Room was on his bucket list. He even wrote his master's thesis on the inside workings of the Situation Room. He turned out to be working there on one of the most perilous days in the history of the Situation Room, January 6th. When the individuals inside the Situation Room were dealing with an insurrection inspired by the president in office at that time, never before had this tension between serving the president and the presidency been tested like this. Stiegler talks about that day in hushed tones, about the moment when Vice President Pence was almost lost, about having to start to implement continuity of government operations, which would ensure the survival of the government, if indeed the insurrection was successful. He was back in the Situation Room the next day, determined to carry on. He was there on President Biden's first day, and I actually asked him if he was tempted to slip President Biden a note of good luck as he gave him his morning briefing. Mike Stiegler said, "No, we serve the presidency, not the president. We serve in silence." Generations of dedicated professionals have served in the Situation Room for the last six decades. It's my honor to tell their story.
Thank you, George. That was George Stephanopoulos with five key insights from The Situation Room, the inside story of presidents in crisis. If you want some more insider stories, check out our book bite for The Joy of Politics, Surviving Cancer, a Campaign, a Pandemic, an Insurrection, and Life's Other Unexpected Curveballs by Senator Amy Klobuchar. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.